And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's April 27th, 117th day of the year. Just 248 days remain till this year's over with. And how the time flies. In AD 395, the Emperor Arcadius marries Aelia Eudoxia, daughter of the Frankish general Flavius Boto. She becomes one of the most powerful Roman empresses of late antiquity. In 711, Islamic conquest of Hispania begins. Moorish troops led by Tariq ibn Ziyad land at Gibraltar to begin their invasion of the Iberian Peninsula. 1296, First War of Scottish Independence. John Balliol's Scottish army is defeated by an English army commanded by John de Warenne, 6th Earl of Surrey at the Battle of Dunbar. 1509, Pope Julius II places the Italian state of Venice under interdict. In other words, it was an ecclesiastical censure, or a ban that prohibits persons, certain active church individuals, or groups from participating in certain rites, or that the rites and services of the church are banished from having validity in certain territories. They displeased him, the entire state. 1521, Battle of Mactan. Emperor Ferdinand Magellan is killed by, explorer Ferdinand Magellan, is killed by natives in the Philippines, led by Chief Lapa-Lapa. 1539, official founding of the city of Bogota, New Granada, nowadays called Colombia, by Nicholas Ferdinand and Sebastian de Balcazar. 1565, Cebu is established, becoming the first Spanish settlement in the Philippines. 1595, the relics of St. Sava are incinerated in Belgrade on the Vračar Plateau by Ottoman Grand Vizier Sinan Pasha. The site of the incineration is now the location of the Church of St. Sava, one of the largest Orthodox churches in the world. 1650, the Battle of Carbisdale. Royalist army from Orkney invades mainland Scotland and is defeated by Coventry army. 1667, blind and impoverished, John Milton sells Paradise Lost to a printer for £10, so it could be entered into the stationer's register. 1805, First Barbary War. U.S. Marines and Berbers attack the Tripolitan city of Derna. That's where the part of the Marines hymn, The Shores of Tripoli, comes from. 1813, this is during the War of 1812, American troops capture York, the capital of Upper Canada, in the Battle of York. 1861, Abraham Lincoln suspends the writ of habeas corpus. So you can be thrown in jail until you rot. Perfectly all right. 1906, the State Duma of the Russian Empire meets for the first time. 1909, Sultan of Ottoman Empire Abdul Hamid II is overthrown, succeeded by his brother Mehmed V. 1911, following the resignation and death of William Fry, compromises reached to rotate the office of President Pro Tem in the U.S. Senate. 1927, Carabineros de Chile, the Chilean National Police Force, and Gendarmerie are created. 1936, United Auto Workers gains autonomy from the American Federation of Labor. 1941, World War II, German troops enter Athens. 1945, World War II. The last German formations withdraw from Finland and Norway. The Lapland War, and thus World War II in Finland, comes to an end, and the raising of the flag on the three-country cairn photograph is taken. 1945, Benito Mussolini is arrested by Italian partisans in Dongo while attempting to escape disguised as a German soldier. 1953, Operation Mula offers $50,000. To any pilot who defected with a fully mission-capable Mikoyan Gurevich MiG-15 to South Korea. The first pilot was to get $100,000. 1967. Expo 67 officially opens in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, with a large opening ceremony broadcast around the world. It opens up to the public the very next day. In 1978, former U.S. President Nixon aide John Ehrlich runs released from an Arizona prison after serving 18 months for Watergate-related crimes. 1978, the Sorrel Revolution begins in Afghanistan. Ends the next day with the murder of Afghan President Mohammad Daoud Khan, the establishment of the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan. When they say Democratic Republic, read Communist. 1981, Xerox PARC introduces the computer mouse. 1986, the city of Pripyat and surrounding areas are evacuated due to the Chernobyl disaster. 1987, U.S. Department of Justice bars Austrian President Kurt Waldheim and his wife Elizabeth, who'd also been a Nazi, from entering the U.S., charging he aided in the deportation and execution of thousands of Jews and others as a German army officer during World War II. 1989, the April 27th demonstrations, which were student-led protests responding to the April 26th editorial during the Tiananmen Square protest of 1989. 1992, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, comprising Serbia and Montenegro, was proclaimed. Also in 1992, Betty Boothroyd becomes the first woman to be elected Speaker of the British House of Commons in its 700-year history. 1992, the Russian Federation and 12 other former Soviet republics become members of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. 1993, most of the Zambian national football team lose their lives in a plane crash off Libreville in Gabon en route to Dakar, Senegal, to play a 1994 FIFA World Cup qualifying match against Senegal. 1994, the South African general election, the first democratic general election in South Africa in which black citizens could vote. The interim constitution also came into force. And in 2005, Airbus A380 aircraft has its maiden test flight. 2006, construction begins on the Freedom Tower, later renamed One World Trade Center, New York City. 2007, Estonian authorities removed the Bronze Soldier, Soviet Red Army War Memorial in Tallinn, amid political controversy with Russia. 2007, Israeli archaeologists discovered the tomb of Herod the Great south of Jerusalem. 2011, the 2011 super outbreak devastates parts of the southeast United States, especially the states of Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and Tennessee. 205 tornadoes touched down on April 27th alone, kills more than 300, injures hundreds more. 2012, at least 4 explosions hit the Ukrainian city of Dnipropetrovsk, with at least 27 people injured. 2018, the Panmunjom Declaration signed between North and South Korea, officially declaring their intent to end the Korean War. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian feast day, Antimus of Nicodemia, Assisicus, Floribert of Liege, John of Constantinople, Liberalis of Treviso, Pollio, Raphael Arnaz Baron, Virgin of Montserrat, Zita, Day of Russian Parliamentarianism in Russia, Day of the Uprising against the Occupying Forces in Slovenia, in Moldova it's Flag Day, Freedom Day in South Africa, Unfreedom Day, and also in South Africa, it's an unofficial holiday. Independence Day celebrates independence of Sierra Leone from the UK in 1961. Independence Day celebrates independence of Togo from France in 1960. King's Day in the Netherlands, Aruba, Curacao, and St. Martin. National Veterans Day in Finland. All right, let's see what else we might have. In 1124, David I becomes King of the Scots. 1296, the Battle of Dunbar. The Scots are defeated by Edward I of England. 1518, the Treaty of St. Trudon, anti-French trapdoors and Burgundish covenant. 1522, the Battle of Bicocca, combined French and Venetian forces, decisively defeated by a Spanish imperial and papal army. 1565, first Spanish settlement in the Philippines. 1576, the Peace of Belleau and Pax de Mansour. 1578, the Duel of the Mignons claims the lives of two favorites of Henry III of France and two favorites of Henry I, Duke of Guise. 1646, King Charles I flees Oxford. 1662, Netherlands and France sign a military covenant. 1694, Frederick August I, also known as the Strong, becomes monarch of Saxony. 1773, the British Parliament passes the Tea Act, which led to the Boston Tea Party. 1813, Americans under General Pike capture Toronto. Pike is killed in the battle. 1828, the Zoological Gardens at Regent's Park in London opens up. 1838, fire destroys half of Charleston. 1840, the foundation stone for the new Palace of Westminster in London is laid by Sarah Barry, wife of the architect Charles Barry. 1860, Thomas Jackson, also known as Stonewall Jackson, is assigned to command Harper's Ferry. 1861, West Virginia secedes from Virginia after Virginia secedes from the Union. 1863 Battle of Straits Raid, Tuscumbia to Cedar Bluff, Alabama. 1865, Cornell University, Ithaca, New York, is chartered. 1865, the steamboat SS Sultana explodes in the Mississippi River. Kills up to 1,800 of the 2,427 passengers in the greatest maritime disaster in U.S. history. Most are paroled Union POWs on their way home after the end of the Civil War. 1874, the White League, a paramilitary white supremacist organization, is formed. 1877, Rutherford B. Hayes removes federal troops from Louisiana. Reconstruction ends. 1890, French troops under Captain Archinard occupy Ouagadougou in West Sudan. 1897, Grant's tomb is dedicated. 1904, the Australian Labor Party under Prime Minister Chris Watson becomes the first labor government in the world. 1909, the Sultan of Turkey, Abdulhamid II, is overthrown. 1910, Belgian Parliament rejects the socialist motion for general voting rights. 1910, Louis Botha and James Herzog establish the moderate nationalist South African Party. It promises equality of Britons and Boers alike. He became the first Prime Minister of South Africa. 1911, Indian passive resistance is suspended when General Zaci Smuts enters into negotiation with Mahatma Gandhi. 1915, there's a counterattack launched by Turkish forces under the command of Mustafa Kemal Ataturk against Allied troops. 1916, the British renew their assault on the Irish volunteer position in Mount Street. Shelling also sets the buildings on fire. 1933, Adolf Hitler authorizes the creation of the Ministry of Aviation. That was part of his move to revive the Luftwaffe under Hermann Göring's command. 1933, Jessup & Son Department Store, Nottingham, England, was acquired by John Lewis Partnership. That was the partnership's first shop outside of London. 1937, the first U.S. Social Security payment is made. 1940, on this date, Himmler orders the establishment of Auschwitz concentration camp. 1943, Polish resistance fighter Witold Pilecki escapes from Auschwitz after having voluntarily been imprisoned to get information about the Holocaust. 1945, the U.S. Fifth Army enters Genoa. Also in 1945, the Volksgesetzer Beobachter, the newspaper of the Nazi Party, ceases publication. 1946, the first radar is installed on board a commercial ship. 1948, the Arab Legion attacks Gusher Bridge on the Jordan River. 1950, South Africa passes the Group Areas Act, which segregates the races. Again, I see no logic to something like that. 1953 on this date. Wrestler Freddie Blassie coins the term pencil neck geek. 1956, undefeated world heavyweight boxing champion Rocky Marciano retires from the ring. 1959, Mao Zedong resigns as chairman of the PRC after the disastrous failure of the Great Leap Forward. Excuse me. 1959, the last Canadian missionary leaves the People's Republic of China. 1960, the first atomic-powered electric drive submarine is launched. 1960, South Korean President Syngman Rhee resigns after 12 years in power. 1963, Cuban Premier Fidel Castro arrives in Moscow. 1968, the Congress of Political Party Radicals, the PPR, forms in the Netherlands. 1968, the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association holds a rally to protest the banning of a Republican Easter parade. 1972, Apollo 16 returns to Earth. 1974, Pan Am Flight 707 crashes into the mountains of Bali. 107 people are killed. 1977, bloody riots break out in Soweto, South Africa. 1981, Paul McCartney's solo rock band Wings disbands on this date. 1982, the trial of John Hinckley begins for the attempted assassination of President Reagan. While he was assassinating Reagan, his father or brother was having lunch with George Bush. 1989, a hurricane in Bangladesh kills over 500. 1992, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which is comprised of Serbia and Montenegro, is proclaimed. 1994, former President Richard Nixon's buried in the Nixon Library in California. You'll find him in the reference section. And on that note, one last thing. In 2011, President Obama, coerced by incessant false birth accusations, publicly releases what he claimed was a copy of his birth certificate. A lot of evidence that it was a computer-generated document, not really his birth certificate. His own brother said he was born in Kenya. But why should we be interrupted with facts? All right. We've been talking about witches and witch hunts and black magic and all that. It wasn't until the 15th century that witch hunting became into its own. Beginning in 1428, a series of witch trials that claimed over 400 began in Valais region of current-day Switzerland. For 30 years, that region had an office of the Inquisition investigated Waldensians. And in the summer of 1428, this morphed into investigating claims of witchcraft when several of the local notables demanded it. Now, if they could get those people burned as witches, they could take their property. By 1428, though, witchcraft had been primarily associated with women for a couple hundred years. Though not entirely. It was a female activity tied to women's sexuality. And a letter written by Pope John the 22nd in 1320 distinguished between sorcerers and witches. In 1437, as the Valais witch trials were going on, an anonymous inquisitor wrote a book that described in detail the black magic rituals of alleged witches. Now, how he got that information is anybody's guess. My guess is most of it was made up. In 1484, a Dominican inquisitor named Heinrich Kramer was expelled from the city of Innsbruck in the Tyrol region of current-day Austria for trying to investigate claims of witchcraft. At his behest, Pope Innocent VIII issued the Summis Disarrantes Effectibus, desiring with supreme ardor, which authorized inquisitors investigating witchcraft to proceed to the correction, imprisonment, and punishment of alleged witches, and threaten anybody who hindered Kramer's work with excommunication, suspension, interdiction, and other terrible sentences, censures, penalties. 2 years later, Kramer included Summis Disarrantes Effectibus in his Melius Maleficarum, Hammer of the Witches, the best known and most important treatise on witchcraft. He claimed that women were more likely to be witches than men, going on to assert, what else is a woman but a foe to friendship? An inescapable punishment, a necessary evil, a natural temptation, a desirable calamity, a domestic danger, a delectable detriment, an evil of nature painted with fair colors. Now, the Protestant Reformation, which started in 1517 when Martin Luther nailed his 95 thesis to the Wittenberg church doors, only increased the Catholic Church's commitment to routing out and destroying heresy, including witchcraft. One consequence was that the 16th century would see many bloody witch trials. 1532, Holy Roman Emperor Charles V issued the first body of German criminal law, known in Latin as the Constitutio Criminalis Carolina, which codified and systemized the various laws in operation in the realms of the empire. Importantly, it also defined the procedures involved in discovering an accused person's guilt or innocence, which did include torture. According to Constitutio Criminalis Carolina, when somebody offers to impart sorcery to another person or threatens to bewitch somebody, and such befalls the threatened person, the aforesaid person otherwise has associated with men or women, sorcerers, or has employed suspicious things, gestures, words, and signs, such as characterized sorcery, when further the said person has a bad reputation of similar sort, then that constitutes a legally sufficient indication of sorcery and is adequate basis upon which to examine that person under torture. I'll beat you till you confess. The Constitutio Criminalis Carolina made it virtually impossible for accused witches to establish their innocence, and if by some miracle an alleged witch was able to exonerate themselves, the judge and complainant incurred no penalty on account of the aforementioned legal and proper examination of the torture. Because the incriminating indication made her out grave reason and excuse for the examination, which did take place. For the law says that one should keep oneself not only from the committing of crime, but also from all appearances of evil of the sort that can cause ill repute or indications of crime. And he who does not do that has himself, in this way, caused his own complaint. And in this case, the accused shall bear his own support while in jail, since he supplied grounds for his being suspected. Well, 10 years after the Constitutio Criminalis Carolina, England's Parliament passed the Witchcraft Act, which made practicing witchcraft a felony and therefore punishable by death. Now, though England's King Henry VIII had broken with the Catholic Church and established Church of England, he retained many Catholic beliefs, such as a concern over witchcraft. Parliament repealed the Witchcraft Act in 1547, but reinstated it in 1563. Now, the new act in some ways softened the terms of the earlier one, reserving death for those cases in which a witch actually harmed somebody. But witchcraft was taken quite seriously. More than 1 in 5 homicides during this period were attributed to witchcraft, with approximately 50% of the accused witches, virtually all of whom were women, being convicted and executed. That's another case where accusation pretty much equaled guilt. Now, these events paled in comparison, though, to the 70-year reign of terror that began in 1560. Between that date and 1630, witch trials across Europe produced the greatest number of executions, with the number of victims stretching into the tens of thousands. In Chelmsford, Essex County, in England, between 1566 and 1586, more than 400 people were accused of practicing witchcraft, and 30 women and one man were hung. England did not burn witches. Essex was a hotbed of witchcraft, apparently accounting for 60% of witch trials and 83% of executions. Women accounted for nearly all the accused witches. 1604, King James I expanded a number of punishable offenses related to witchcraft. A believer in the power of the occult, James I's fascination with and fear of witches likely accounts for the presence in William Shakespeare's 1611 play Macbeth of the Weird Sisters. Three witches who at one point hunch over a bubbling cauldron, adding grotesque ingredients to their brew while chanting an incantation. Now, they're portrayed as vile and evil, but they're also portrayed as powerful, and their prophecies drive the play's action. The year after Macbeth was first performed, two witch trials in Lancashire, one in Salisbury and the other in Pendle Hill, resulted in the death of nearly a dozen people, almost all of whom were women. Across the English Channel in 1632, the Catholic Church burned at the stake a priest named Urbain Grenadier, who was allegedly directing evil spirits to possess the Ursuline nuns living in a nearby convent. Now that Grenadier had run afoul, the local bishop was a critic of priestly celibacy. He did little to help his case, and he was burned in public, although the so-called possessions continued for a number of years. Kansas self-styled witch finder general terrorized southeastern England. Just over a year, he was alleged to be responsible for the execution of at least 100 folks, and possibly many more. His results were likely due to the liberal use of the sleep deprivation, cutting with a knife, and swimming. Now, swimming was tying the accused to a chair and tossing the chair into water. In addition, Hopkins and his associates would shave accused witches and prick them with knives in order to discover the mark of the devil. Now, when he died in 1647, his reign of terror came to an end, but by then his methods, described in a book he published called The Discovery of Witches, had been carried across the Atlantic to Great Britain's North American colonies. 1658, a woman named Elizabeth Garlick was put on trial for witchcraft in East Hampton, New York. February that year, a 16-year-old woman named Elizabeth Gardner Howell, who had recently given birth, began raving about strange visions she was having. A few days later, she died. Suspicion quickly turned to Garlick, who allegedly committed all manner of damage on her neighbors. Garlick was tried for witchcraft, but found not guilty. As the 17th century came to a close, the fever witch hysteria began slowly breaking in Europe, but only after an estimated 50,000 accused witches, mostly women, were burned at the stake and more than 25,000 were hung. About 80% of the executed were women thought to be in cahoots with the devil and filled with lust. Germany had the highest witchcraft execution rate, while Ireland had the lowest. 1682, France's King Louis XIV curbed further witch trials. That same year, Englishmen hung Mary Trembles and Susanna Edward, the last two individuals executed for witchcraft in that country. In fact, the most famous witchcraft trials, those in Salem, Massachusetts in 1692, were something of a last gasp of witch hunting in the English-speaking world. 1717, England had its last trial for witchcraft, and the case was thrown out. If memory serves correctly, the woman accused had with her a written spell. The judge demanded to see it, and he recognized it as something he himself had written while in college. Two decades later, Parliament adopted the Witchcraft Act of 1735, which criminalized the pretense of witchcraft, implying that legislators no longer believe witchcraft actually existed. In the coming decades, several other countries ended witchcraft trials, though the last person prosecuted for witchcraft in the U.S. was Joseph Stout, who in the early 1830s was arrested on suspicion of witchcraft in Tennessee. Grand jury refused to indict him, and he countersued the men who arrested him. They tried to defend themselves on the basis of the English Witchcraft Act, which Tennessee had never repealed. The judge rejected that defense, but dismissed the case, bringing an end to the last American witchcraft trial. By the 20th century, witches had joined vampires, ghouls, goblins, and as just another element of spooky Halloween fun. Though completely identified with women, in 1939 film version of Wizard of Oz included both good and bad witches. By the 1960s, witches and witchcraft had become the fodder for a popular television show called Bewitched, which ran for 8 years and was so iconic that Salem, Massachusetts installed a bronze statue of the show's main character, Samantha Stevens. About the same time, feminists adopted the images of witches and witchcraft to mobilize support for the women's liberation movement. 1968, members of the recently dissolved New York Radical Women's formed a new organization, Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell. The initials spelled out the word witch, which advocated solidarity with other left-leaning causes, which, of course, was short-lived and primarily a political rather than a spiritual and religious organization. But at that same time, the early 1970s saw a resurgent American interest in pre-Christian religious traditions. It's led to a lot of people embracing witchcraft. For instance, some embraced Wicca, a witchcraft-based religion, the roots of which emerged in England in the 1920s. Spurred by the 1951 repeal of the Witchcraft Act of 1735, Wiccans began to evangelize their beliefs. By the late 1960s, Wicca had spread to the U.S. and often allied itself with causes like environmentalism and feminism. Wicca doesn't have a central authority figure or form of dogma. Its members include atheists, monotheists, and polytheists. In general, Wicca focuses on ritual rather than belief, with the goal being activating a religious experience and building a sense of community among coven members. Throughout the year, Wiccans gather for various sabbat, or seasonal festivals, during which they cast spells in a ritually purified magic circle. Often, Wiccans will invoke a cone of power, which is thought to combine the energy of the members of the magic circle and direct it toward a stated goal. Wiccans typically avoid evil and the appearance of evil at all costs. Their motto is harm none, and they strive to live a peaceful, tolerant, and balanced life in tune with nature and humanity. Their spells and incantations are often derived from their Book of Shadows, a 20th century collection of wisdom and witchcraft, and can be compared to the act of prayer in other religions. Modern-day witchcraft potion is more likely to be an herbal remedy for the flu instead of a hex to harm somebody. Popularity of Wiccas grown again in the U.S. in recent decades. In the almost 30 years since 1990, the number of self-described Wiccans has grown from 8,000 to almost a million. 1986, the U.S. officially recognized Wicca as a religion. In 2007, the Department of Defense began issuing headstones, grave markers, and memorial plaques with Wiccan symbols. Now, the upsurge in Wicca's popularity is partially due to the phenomenal success of the Harry Potter books that introduced a new generation of readers to witches and witchcraft. Modern-day witches of the Western world still struggle to shake their historical stereotype, however, even though today's witchcraft spells usually used to stop somebody from doing evil or harming themselves. Ironically, while it's probable some historical witches use witchcraft for evil purposes, many likely embrace practices aimed at healing or protection against the immorality they were accused of. But witches, whether actual or accused, still face persecution and death. Several women and a few men suspected of being witchcraft have been beaten and killed in Papua New Guinea since 2010, including a young mother who was burned alive. Similar episodes of violence against people accused of being witches have occurred in Africa, South America, and the Middle East, and a number of immigrant communities in Europe and the U.S. Well, when you talk about witches and witchcraft, one thought that comes to mind, of course, are the witchcraft trials in Salem. And the trials that took place over 400 years ago were so brutally unjust, they have an impact even today. Now, few events actually loom as large in American history as the Salem witch trials. Almost 400 years after the trials ended, historians can't agree on the exact causes of the witchcraft hysteria that gripped Salem between February 1692 and May of 1693 and cost the lives of more than two dozen men and women. Now, Salem was settled in 1626 by Roger Conant, a Puritan or English Protestant who separated from the Church of England. And by the 1690s, the inhabitants of the town and the surrounding area had earned a reputation for being quarrelsome and litigious, even by the region's famously quarrelsome and litigious standards. In 1689, the village hired Puritan Samuel Parris to be Salem village's minister, the fourth in 16 years. Now, Parris was arrogant and pretentious, and he did little to calm the village's fractiousness and may have even made it worse. In fact, the village voted in October 1691 not to pay a salary, which certainly did little to improve relations between Parris and Salem. Prior to that, in 1688, Anne Glover, an Irish washerwoman in Boston, was tried and executed for being a witch after several children began exhibiting unusual behavior, such as two allegedly bedeviled girls in the illustration that usually goes along with the Salem witch trials. Following year, prominent Boston minister Cotton Mather published a memorial providences relating to witchcraft and possessions that included extensive information about the Glover case that was widely read in Massachusetts. Against this backdrop, the famous witchcraft hysteria and trials broke out. In mid-January of 1692, 9-year-old Betty Parris and 11-year-old Abigail Williams, a relative living in the Parris household, began acting very strangely in ways similar to those of the girls in the Glover case. Soon, a number of other young ladies began exhibiting the same symptoms. Within a few weeks, the consensus was the girls had been bewitched. On February 29th, following complaints by several Salem residents, the local magistrates, Jonathan Corwin and John Hawthorne, issued arrest warrants for Tituba. Okay. Tituba, a woman enslaved by the Parris family, and two other women whom the girls accused of witchcraft, Sailor Good and Sarah Osborne, were all locked up. After lengthy questioning, Tituba admitted to being a witch and confirmed that Good and Osborne were her co-conspirators. Parris preached a sermon in which he implied the village's church had been infiltrated by witches opposed to his ministry, which only fueled the hysteria. Over the next 15 months, over 200 folks were accused of being witches. But that's only the beginning of what you might refer to as the horror. Between June and September 1692, at least 21 people died as a result of the hysteria. The most gruesome execution was certainly that of Giles Corey on September 19, 1692. He had refused to enter a plea in response to the charges against him. Under the law, prosecution could not proceed. Well, not a plea, but to avoid defendants using this as a get-out-of-jail-free card, prosecutors are authorized to resort to torture In this particular case, they opted for what the French referred to as hard and forceful punishment, involved placing ever heavier stones on a person's chest until he or she gave in and entered a plea. Well, Corey refused, allegedly mocking his tortures by demanding more weight. He was eventually pressed to death. The only instance this happened in U.S. history. 3 days after he died, the Salem Witch Trials claimed their last eight victims. On October 3, 1692, respected Boston minister and president of Harvard College, Increase Mather, denounced the use of spectral evidence in witchcraft trials. Spectral evidence was evidence that came from the ether as opposed to concrete evidence. Shortly after that, Massachusetts Governor William Phipps temporarily stopped the proceedings. And on October 29th, he abolished the Court of Oyer and Terminer, which was then hearing the cases. January the next year, the newly created Superior Court of Judicature, Court of Assizes, and General Gaol Delivery convened to hear the remaining witchcraft cases. Only three additional people were found guilty, and the trials wound down by the summer. At that point, the Salem witch trials were officially over. For a lot of years, Salem and the descendants of those involved tried to distance themselves from the events of 1692. Famed author Nathaniel Hawthorne, descendant of Magistrate John Hawthorne, who never repented his role in the trials, likely changed the spelling of his last name to distance himself from his infamous ancestor. 1953, Arthur Miller's play The Crucible made the events of Salem a key example of hysteria and intolerance. Beginning in the 1960s, though, Salem began embracing its connection to witchcraft. In 1970, the hit show Bewitched filmed several episodes in and around Salem, and in 1982, the town hosted the first of its annual Haunted Happenings Festival. Now, to commemorate the witch trials' 300th anniversary in 1692, the town unveiled the Witch Trial Memorial, which was dedicated to noted Holocaust survivor, Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel. Well, along with witchcraft, another thing that folks look at with a great deal of suspicion are psychic abilities. From ancient Mayan prophecies to those of Nostradamus and the biblical predictions and revelations, clairvoyants have long been with us. But the question is, do psychics actually exist? Now, the term psychic, meaning a person who has extrasensory perception, dates to the 19th century. The idea of clairvoyance, a French word meaning clearer vision, goes all the way back to ancient times with fortune tellers offering prophecies on all manner of future events, especially about the end of the world. Variously called divination, soothsaying, prophesizing, or fortune-telling, the specific practices have changed over the years and taken a variety of forms: astrology, augury, clairvoyance, palm, tarot card reading. Interest in these occult activities has waxed and waned throughout the millennia, experienced important revivals in the Renaissance era in the 19th century. One of the latest revivals of these procedures, today's so-called New Age movement, combines Western and non-Western forms of divination and demonstrates humanity's ongoing interest in using supernatural means to predict the future. Now, the word occult can bring to mind dark magic, black masses, other unfavorable imagery, but it simply refers to any supernatural belief, matter, practices, especially those involving mysticism, magic, and spirituality. Therefore includes all varieties of divination. The word actually means hidden. One of the oldest and most widespread form of divination is astrology, on the search for prophecies in the stars. This practice goes back at least as far as 2000 BC, and it may even be older. During the First Empire, about 1894 to 1595 BC, Babylonians associated their patron god Marduk with the planet Jupiter and other lesser gods with Venus and Saturn and Mercury and Mars. They observed the seasonal movements of celestial bodies, believing those movements reflected divine intervention in public affairs and the welfare of the king as opposed to the lives of the individual. Because of their intense fascination with astrology, early Babylonian astronomers developed a concept of constellations or groups of stars that appear to form a pattern, and the modern-day zodiac evolved from these early Babylonian patterns. By approximately the 16th century BC, the Babylonians had developed a complex system of between 6,500 and 7,000 omens, recorded on several dozen tablets known as the Enuma Anu Enlil, that connected a broad range of astronomic and atmospheric conditions to make predictions about the future. The Babylonians' astrological system spread east to Asia and west to Greece, where in both cases it merged with the local cultures of pre-existing beliefs. The Greeks in particular left a lasting impact on modern astrology by focusing on the ascendant, or the astrological sign that's ascending the eastern horizon, coinciding with a specific time or event. The Greeks called this horoscopus, or hour marker, from which the word horoscope is derived. The use of astrological signs to predict future events surely appealed to the Greeks, who had a millennia-long tradition of consulting oracles. Allegedly, the gods themselves spoke through these oracles, offering cryptic messages and prophecies. The oracle could refer to a priest or priestess who receives prophecies on a particular site for divination. The oldest oracle site, Dodona, in northwestern Greece, perhaps dates as far back as 1600 BC. Initially, it was likely a site for worshiping a mother goddess, but over time, Dodona transitioned to celebrating Zeus, the king of the gods. It's mentioned in Homer's The Iliad when Achilles invokes High Zeus, lord of Dodona, Pelasgian, living afar off, brooding over wintry Dodona. In the Odyssey, Odysseus journeys to Dodona to consult Zeus about whether he should return home to Ithaca in disguise. And though Dodona was the oldest Greek oracle, it was far from the only one. Others included the temple of Asclepius, god of medicine, and the oracles of Troponius and Menethius. For the Battle of Issus in 333 BC, Alexander the Great traveled to the oracle of Amun in the Siwa Oasis in northwestern Egypt. Maybe the best-known oracle in modern readers is the Oracle at Delphi, dedicated to the Greeks' national god Apollo. And there, Apollo's mouthpiece, a female priestess called Pythia, was the Greeks' highest civil and religious authority. The Pythias answered questions from Greeks and foreigners alike, and the oracle had a reputation for delivering accurate, if enigmatic, prophecies. It was the Pythia who supposedly said that Socrates was the wisest man because he knew he was ignorant, predicted that King Leonidas I of Sparta would die fighting the Persians or his city would fall to those invaders. After the Romans conquered Greece in the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, they adopted many of the Greeks' religious and astrological beliefs, and occult practices spread throughout Rome's sprawling empire. Sometime in the 2nd century AD, a Greek polymath named Claudius Ptolemy, living in Roman-occupied Alexandria, compiled what was considered the authoritative text on astrology, which made him the most famous Greek astrologer. That text was later translated into Arabic and Latin, became a foundation text for medieval Christian astrology. Yet despite astrology being widespread, many contemporaries were skeptical of the stars' ability to accurately predict the future. For instance, in the 1st century B.C., Roman statesman and scholar Marcus Tullius Cicero dismissed most forms of divination, including astrology, in a work he wrote, which translated as Concerning Divination. Nor was he alone. In the late 2nd century A.D., Roman skeptic Sextus Empiricus released a series of books titled Against the Learned, book 5 of which was titled Against the Astrologers. In the 3rd century, Plotinus, one of the most influential philosophers in the ancient world, argued that while the planets had souls, their movements couldn't predict or control human behavior. But despite these criticisms of astrology, it appears that generally most ancient Greeks and Romans considered the practice a valid and useful method of predicting the future. Rather than looking toward the heavens for prophecy, some ancients looked at animals' livers in a practice known as hepatoscopy. As far back as the Babylonians, divinators believed they could deduce the gods' intentions by reading the livers of ritually sacrificed sheep and birds. Nor were they unique in this belief. The Etruscans, a people who occupied northern and western Italy before Rome emerged, also practiced this form of divination. Later on, both the Greeks and the Romans partook in a practice that the Romans called aruspice, which involved divining meaning from animal entrails. This was also closely related to the Greek and Roman practice of augury, which observed and interpreted the behavior of birds. In fact, this form of augury was central to the myth of Rome's founding. According to tradition, Romulus and Remus, the twin brothers who allegedly founded Rome, selected a site for the city by observing the behavior of vultures. Now, looking for signs in animal bodies wasn't limited to the Western cultures. In Asia, people would examine the bones of slaughtered animals, usually the shoulder bones of oxen or deer or pigs, in hopes of divining the future. Several Asian countries, including China and Japan, have millennia-old traditions of casting lots, a catch-all term for dice, pebbles, balls, or even slips of paper that are thrown and whose final resting place allegedly reveals the will of a deity or events to come. Instead of looking at animal entrails, some diviners turn to the human body as an instrument for predicting the future. One of the most popular forms of this type of divination was palmistry, or reading the palms. Practice appears to have originated in ancient India, dating back as far as the 7th century B.C., and spread to China, Persia, and Greece by about 500 B.C. It was practiced by the philosopher and astrologist Anaxagoras, 500 B.C. A century later, the famed Greek philosopher Aristotle introduced palmistry to his student, Alexander the Great, who enthusiastically embraced the practice. His military exploits undoubtedly contributed to the spread of palmistry. Occult divination in the ancient world, though, wasn't limited to the continents east of the Atlantic. In the Mesoamerican cultures of the current-day Central America, various forms of divination are widely practiced. Scholars suggest Mesoamerica's oldest known major civilization, the Olmecs, believe that mirrored surfaces could be used to divine the future, a method known as scrying. This practice was adopted by the later Mayan Aztec cultures. Today, the most famous prediction allegedly made in Mesoamerica is associated with the Mayan calendar. Though the most famous form of the Maya people's calendar is round, their long count calendars are much larger and carved into tall monuments known as stelas. These calendars are sometimes accompanied by the inscription made predictions, but it wasn't a prediction that spurred the rumor that the calendar predicted the world's end on December 21st, 2012. It was the form of the calendar itself. The long count calendars track cycles of time known as Bakatu, which are 144,000 days long. One such period ended December 21st, 2012, and when people saw the coming that was coming in a long count calendar, some interpreted it as a prediction of the end of the world. Obviously, if you're listening to this, the world didn't end on that date. Scholars had refuted that interpretation even before time proved it wrong, that this date was just the end of a major cycle, which wasn't the first or last cycle in the Mayan people's count of time. They believed the end of a cycle is a time of rebirth and transformation, but not the end of time or the world itself. They had, in fact, had other calendars and calculations that projected 7,000 years beyond now into the future. Even so, some conspiracy theorists continue to believe that the Maya people predicted the end of the world, not just on December 21st, 2012. Some have asserted it would come in June of 2020 or December 21st, 2020, or maybe even that date in 2021. But so far, they've not been accurate. While the ancient Maya people are often associated with predicting the end of the world, many of today's most popular religions do have some form of eschatology, beliefs and predictions about the end of the world as we know it. Maybe that's at least in part why the erroneous interpretation of the Mayan calendar became so popular. The Christian New Testament ends with the book of Revelation, which the author prophesies of the violent apocalypse and the second coming of Jesus, when the dead will be resurrected and a new world will be formed. Jewish theology includes beliefs about the end of days, meaning the end of the world, that precedes God raising the dead and remaking the world for a new era of justice and peace. Muslims also believe in a day of judgment, also called the day of resurrection. Another example of God unmaking the world and make it again for a new and better era for the devout. The date and time for the ultimate destruction of this world and the birth of the new one has indeed been prophesied for centuries. In the 2nd century B.C., the Jewish Essene sect predicted an end-time battle would happen about 70 A.D. Sylvester II, who became Pope in 999, believed the world would end in 1000. Martin Luther, whose work started the Protestant Reformation, reportedly believed the world would end no later than 1600. Christopher Columbus wrote an entire book of prophecies and predicted the world would end in 1656.
Cotton Mather, who was involved in the Salem witch trials, predicted a world would end in 1697, 1716, and 1736. Excuse me. He amended the year each time he got it wrong, but he died before he could find out he was wrong about the last date as well. There was a bit of hysteria in 1910 when people thought the passing of Halley's Comet signaled the end. Jehovah's Witnesses at one time believed 1941 would be the world's final year, but when that didn't happen, they changed their prediction for destruction in 1975. Of course, people predicted the end of the world would coincide with the end of the millennium, often citing these lines from Nostradamus. The year 1999 and 7 months from the skies have come a great and frightening king. Despite the widespread practice of predicting the end of the world and the acceptance of various forms of divination, the Jewish and Christian traditions that emerged in the Greco-Roman world were at best ambivalent and often outright hostile to such practices, at least prior to the Middle Ages. Part of the problem was the contradictory attitude toward divination expressed in the Bible. On the one hand, Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 10 specifically directs that nobody should be found among you who makes a son or daughter pass through fire or practices divination or is a soothsayer and an augur or a sorcerer. And in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 26, plainly instructs the Jews, you shall not practice augury or witchcraft. On the other hand, there are a great number of prophets in the Bible who not only receive messages from God and angels, but also make predictions about the future, which included the birth, death, and resurrection of a Messiah, the second coming of which will mean the end of the world as we know it. While the prophets of the Bible were given knowledge of the future from God, that's not to say it had a strictly positive opinion of other psychic practices. For instance, there are several references to clairvoyants who can't be trusted. In Genesis chapter 41, Pharaoh has a dream that his various seers are unable to interpret. A similar scene takes place in the fourth chapter of the Bible's book of Daniel when the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar calls all his nation's wise men, which include magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners, and they're not able to interpret the meaning of his dream. These stories demonstrate that Judaism and Christianity distrusted psychics. And in 314, the Catholic Church went so far as to impose a penalty of 5 years of penance on Christians who consulted magicians, a term that certainly included psychics. Though not specifically mentioned in the Bible, the medieval Catholic Church also took a dim view of the practice of palm reading, which was then known as chiromancy, from the Greek word for hand, seeing it as one of the seven forbidden arts. And while the Church didn't forbid all magic and divination, it believed there was a difference between natural magic, which they thought came from God, and black magic that came from Satan. For centuries, it sought to revere the former and root out the latter. Though at the time, many saints and even some popes made psychic predictions that made them vulnerable in the eyes of the church. Famously, the 6th century Irish abbot Columba of Iona, who is credited with spreading Christianity in what's today Scotland, was well respected for having made predictions that later proved accurate, including the time of his own death. Well, on that note, we come to the end of today's show. We're out of time. We'll be back tomorrow and talk more about the world of the paranormal. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.